Chapter 2. Alchemist. In the early days it was a joke, a name given to the shadowy figure by the press, and based on an old and not terribly witty comment. "We call the man Alchemist," a detective had said at a press conference following the sudden and violent death of two Mossad agents who had been passing through London when, to use the current Americanism, they got whacked. "We call him Alchemist," the policeman continued, "because we've come to believe in his ability to turn lead, cupronickel, steel, whatever, into gold. To change the base metals of bullets into gold. I suppose we could have called him Midas, but we opted for Alchemist." By the early days, we're talking 11, maybe 12 years ago. 2 years went by before various law enforcement agencies linked the killings to one person or group of people. Couldn't believe it to start with, for those were all spectaculars. Shootings, but puzzling mysteries. Like locked room murders, some of them. Especially in the bad old days, when a proliferation of splinter groups vied with one another, carrying terror into obscure places by devious means. Eventually, from those first couple or 3 years, they tied several deaths to one source. All were high-profile deaths, each one associated with some form of terrorism. It was, of course, the varied nature of the targets that had everyone fooled to begin with. You don't expect enemies to get themselves killed with the same weapon, and hence by the same organization. Commander Joe Bain had been a chief super, just cutting his teeth on the ways of terrorists, when he put forward the theory that this was a hired gun, or guns. In London, Belfast, Dublin, Paris, Berlin, Madrid, Jerusalem, even Tokyo, they laughed at this ridiculous theory. Indeed, it was laughable, because the watchword in those days was intelligence. But as the years passed, police forces were slow to admit this was the name of the game. Pure detection worked only in the books of Ruth Rendell, P.T. James, and the like. You collared sneak thieves, pickpockets and drug barons, even some killers, by listening and putting people on your payroll. And if it worked for those kind of villains, it was even more true of terrorists. Joe Bain was the man who finally proved, a decade before he called Bex back to his office on her wedding night, that the killings of an Iranian torturer, two PLO bombers, a Red Brigade informer, the armourer of an IRA splinter group, a Latin American country's chief of police with a poor record in human rights, and a senior East German IO were all inexplicably linked. Like a chain. The same weapon was used in each murder, a 38mm Smith & Wesson revolver, and the killer had left a bizarre series of clues that had, until then, been overlooked. From the bodies of each victim, one in the case of the two PLO men, they had recovered neatly typed cards, each with an apt Shakespearean quotation. In the last 10 years, there had been a further 8 bodies laid at Alchemist's door. The Mossad agents, whose deaths had tripped the serial nature of the killings, had died in a cold and calculated manner, the back of their heads blown away by the same Smith & Wesson weapon, and a card with a Shakespearean quote tucked into one of the men's breast pocket. The police did not reveal this last piece of evidence, with its quotation, "Hath not a Jew eyes," a direct quote from Shylock in The Merchant of Venice. So the newspapers finally, in the late 1980s, dubbed him Alchemist, just as they had in the 70s named Ilyich Ramirez Sanchez, leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, Carlos the Jackal, from Mr. Forsyth's book The Day of the Jackal. Alchemist was born of a headline, and those who used him, those who serviced him also, gave him the name which eventually he took as his own. This was a person, they finally had to admit, who ran death as a business, even advertised in newspapers. Genuine calls only. Any bona fide freedom fighters requiring the use of a trained mercenary to carry out death squad work. Reasonable rates. Then a telephone number that, when traced, turned out to be an electronic jape leading up its own backside. But Alchemist was no joke. He was a killer without a single cause. One who, by deed, if not thought and word, allied himself to any cause for a few hours, or a finger count of days. One of the main problems was that you would not expect a terrorist group to employ someone outside their ranks, but they did, particularly for the truly difficult targets, and nobody, on the ground or in the various centres that housed anti-terrorist officers, could at first untangle the strange web. In the beginning, the wisdom said that this particular group, originally they thought of alchemists as a number of people, probably the Provisional Irish Republican Army, PIRA, was filling its coffers by being killers for hire. When they traced it back, of course, this was not so. Matters became bizarre, and alchemists appeared to be something to really fear. This was long before the ceasefires and Good Friday agreements in Northern Ireland. The primary victims were impossible targets. There were some 20 or 30 bodies in the last decade, but it was the first two that had thrown them off the scent for a long time. First, there was a senior officer of the Royal Ulster Constabulary, RUC, the highly controversial paramilitary police force of Northern Ireland, now reorganised and renamed, but still brimful of controversy. The RUC man had a round-the-clock bodyguard and a fleet of cars and armoured vehicles at his disposal, all any man of his standing could require. Yet he died, shot dead in the bedroom of a safe house, where he'd planned to meet an informer in utter secrecy. Instead of an informer, he met Alchemist, who not only came in through the man's window with the silenced S&W revolver, but was also close enough to lay hands on his target, leaving the typed card in a uniform pocket. "For some must watch while some must sleep." Hamlet. And this in an area owned by the Royal Ulster Constabulary. Unheard of since the beginning of the Troubles. You did not go after an impossible victim. 6 months after the RUC officer, there was the Lieutenant Colonel from the SAS, the Special Air Service Regiment, that most highly popular shadowy unit with which the Airborne and the Royal Marine Commandos made up British Special Forces. The colonel was guarded by the usual long-haired men of steel who merged into the background, and he was known to be in charge of the two-man teams that went undercover on special assignment, which in turn meant killers. This officer, protected by killers and controlling killers, was another impossible choice. Impossible, but he made a mistake. Holed up in a cottage deep inside what was then the dangerous bandit country of Armagh, the colonel had slipped outside to meet somebody without telling his men what he was doing and why he was doing it. Unheard of and unlikely. For these men, like the Royal Marine Commandos, did not make mistakes. But it happened, and the colonel made his quietus with a silenced bullet in the back of the head and a card tucked into his camouflage jacket. "I am fire and air, Antony and Cleopatra." Even in the final days of the Troubles, many found it difficult to make the real connection. Many still plumped for a team of possibly dedicated Republicans who were shit-hot at entrapment, had long memories, and could wait for the moment. From the death of the RUC officer and the Lieutenant Colonel of the Special Air Service, there were many other bodies. Toward the present, another Iraqi secret policeman close to the main man. A young woman in Hamburg who had, in secret, run an aggressive fascist group and only stayed in business because she was untouchable. Then almost a year later, two PLO men thought to have been behind the bombing of a commercial airliner. This pair met their end in Libya, where the regime sheltered them from attempts by both the United States and the United Kingdom to have them extradited. One night they did something they'd never done before, went together to the house of a close friend. They arrived in the same car and died as they were getting out onto the pavement. Nobody saw it happen. Nobody saw or heard the bullets or glimpsed the figure slipping cards onto bodies. Somewhere around the original third and fourth targets, OS-13, the anti-terrorist branch from New Scotland Yard, began to build the model, draw the map, plot the plan. At first they did not want to believe it because it was too bizarre. An apolitical contract killer, a man with no qualms, no ideals, and no morals, willing to take huge, absurd risks and snuff unattainable victims.